You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Anyone who's been swept away by the opening sentence of a novel has fallen in love with a fictional character who has missed a train stop because they're engrossed in a book is likely to enjoy Richard Cohn's latest, How to Write Like Tolstoy. In it, Mr. Cohn looks at how some of the world's greatest writers have succeeded or fallen short in their efforts to develop memorable dialogue, create a strong point of view, and even to write effectively about sex. Richard Cohn is the founder of a publishing company that bears his name. He's taught creative writing. He's the author of three books. And for the past 45 years, as an editor, he's worked with Kingsley Amis, Sebastian Faulks, V.S. Pritchett, Studs Terkel, and many others. Richard Cohn's book is published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me on.
My first thought when I saw your book's title was, begin by being a genius, and in Tolstoy's case, a troubled genius.
Well, when I told friends that that was the title I'd chosen, they said, oh, you mean write 1,000 pages in Russian? And I stuck with the title because a lot of the books which talk about writing have slightly plodding titles, you know, how to write a bestseller in 10 steps or whatever. And I wanted to be a little mischievous.
And you have a whole section here, a footnote on the titles that could have been, and we're grateful that the famous titles we wound up with, Gone with the Wind and the like, or The Great Gatsby, were the ones that finally were chosen. How important is a title?
It can be very important. I mean, if a book really gets people behind it. I'm not saying that Catcher in the Rye is a great title, but once enough people are saying this is wonderful, the actual title seems to drop away from importance. But it can be make or break. In James Bond, one of the James Bond adventures was going to be, it came to be called Moonraker, but during the time of its writing and for several months afterwards, its title was Mondays Are Hell.
Well, it's true. So, but it really doesn't say much about James Bond.
No.
This looks like it must have been a fun book to write because it required reading a lot of wonderful literature. You say that when you were young, you read the entire collection of Agatha Christie mysteries. What did she teach you about writing?
Well, the most important thing, whatever kind of book it is, that the reader wants to keep turning the page. I loved Agatha Christie while friends were saying, you know, she can't really write, her characterization is minimal. And I say, I don't mind. It's a wonderful puzzle. And when I first went into book publishing, I was an editor at a company called William Collins, who'd published nearly all her books.
The British publisher.
It's now part of HarperCollins here in the States. I made friends with the woman who's a kind of doyen of crime writing, a woman called Elizabeth Walter. And she had taken on responsibility for editing, looking after Agatha Christie, and she hated her books, and I admitted I loved them. So we struck a deal. When a new script came in, I'd be allowed to read it first, as long as I then wrote the jacket blurb for it, and Elizabeth could just pass it on for copy editing.
It is interesting that so many of the great mystery writers of Britain were women, while the best ones in the United States were men. Dorothy Sayers, for example.
P.D. James, more recently, Ruth Rendell. It may be that clever women often didn't have jobs commensurate with their intelligence and, rather than being idle, decided to write something that would test them. And mystery novels or whodunits was the way out.
You've included advice from a number of prominent contemporary authors, including Francine Prose, Jonathan Franzen, and Nick Hornby. Did you speak to those authors or... did you just pick from things that they'd written about their own processes?
Well, they've all written extremely well about it. Jonathan Franzen, I spoke to before his last novel came out. We were actually met at a party. I didn't pick him out for interview. And he was talking about the struggle he was having with a particular character. I shouldn't say more, as it's a private conversation. But it was interesting just to hear how he was determined to solve that particular problem. It didn't come easy to him.
You begin your book with a chapter on how to begin and end it with a chapter on endings. Do the writers you've worked with tend to struggle more over starting or finishing their books?
They can do. I mean, you began as an artist. You may know of a short biography of Giacometti, where the writer who was sitting for Giacometti talks about Giacometti's anxieties about starting, and he'd choose almost any excuse before he actually got down to the business. And I think that's true of all the arts. Doesn't have to be true. Some people rush with great confidence into what they're writing, but for a lot of people, that we're all faced with a blank canvas or a blank page, and it can be a real struggle as to what you do next.
Some people sit down at a desk for a given amount of time, 9 to 5, let's say. Several guests have told me they do that. But I've read that Hemingway needed to have all of his pencils sharpened before he could start. Friedrich Schiller liked to have a small, the smell of rotten apples concealed under his desk when he was composing poetry. It sounds strange, but he needed that. Orhan Pamuk said, in the mornings, I used to say goodbye to my wife like someone going to work. I'd leave the house, walk a few blocks, and come back like a person arriving at the office.
There are wonderful stories about the particular hang-ups that writers had. Ibsen had a photograph of Strindberg above his desk because he hated him, and so he got going out of his hatred. Scott Fitzgerald used to strip naked before he began. I wouldn't say every piece of writing, but certainly a lot of his novels. Woody Allen likes to take constant showers during the day to inspire him to the next line. Everybody has their own way.
Have you talked to them about that?
I've talked to some authors. Helma Wurlitzer said she has to have the names of her characters in her mind before she starts.
And some writers will tell you that they need the beginning and the end, but they don't know the middle. But ends seem to be a real problem for a lot of writers. And you even have a wonderful cartoon. You mentioned a wonderful cartoon in which a man is at a typewriter thinking, oh, hell. Suddenly a fusillade of shots rang out and they all fell down dead. The end.
Well, of course, now it wouldn't be a typewriter. I mean, John Irving has said that he doesn't begin a novel until he knows what the very last line is going to be. But you get, I mean, major writers such as George Eliot admitted to friends that with The Mill on the Floss, she stumbled over the ending. She didn't get it right. She kind of boxed herself into a corner, and the book ends, as we have it now, in a way that always displeased her.
But you say that, you give four examples of fiction that end in a satisfying way, and Middlemarch, one of probably her greatest novel, is one of the ones you include. The others, Great Gatsby, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Wuthering Heights. What makes those endings so satisfactory?
I think it's because, obviously, the story gets rounded off in a way that the reader finds satisfying.
But is it important to have the ends, all the ends tied up, all the loose ends?
Not necessarily, although readers look for that. I think one of the things which might surprise people is the rhythm of those books' endings is somehow satisfying. That one thinks of music being the property of poetry, but rhythm in prose writing is one. It's one of the chapters that I include. It's really important for a story to work well.
I've often found myself knowing that the book is about to end and feeling the author kind of ending it and just hesitating a bit, rushing past the last two paragraphs to get to the final paragraph.
Well, that's the trouble with a book one loves. One wants it to go on, and yet you read more and more quickly. There's no solution to that, nor is there really. I suppose there is in an audio book that you don't know. But the problem with the book is you can see how many pages you've still got to go. So whether the murderer is supposedly unmasked and there's still a third of the book to go, or X falls in love with Y and they seem to be happily entranced, that isn't going to be the case if you've still got 100 pages to read.
My guest is Richard Cohen, whose latest book is How to Write Like Tolstoy, A Journey into the Minds of Our Greatest Writers. What are the important things a writer needs to accomplish with the first sentence of a book? I've had a number of writers tell me that they couldn't start until they had the first sentence. Others have said that they start a book and then go back, and the first sentence only makes sense to them after they have already been a few chapters into the book.
a number of writers say that the first sentence kind of leads you down the garden path in the sense that it commits you to what comes next. Others, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for instance, said, you know, it's the first paragraph that matters, and you can extend that. But it's not really a how-to book. I've written a book that's looking at the range of the Western canon of fiction writers and seen how they've struggled with things. And it occurred to me that you can divide the first sentences of novels into three kinds. There's grabbers, which you particularly get in suspense novels or whodunits or whatever. You know, X died that afternoon or whatever it might be. Then there are invitational beginnings where obviously the author wants you to read on, but it's a quieter beginning. It's particularly the kind of beginning that was used in the 19th century when people maybe had more time, more leisure. And then there's the third category, which could include either of the first two, which is when the writer beguiles you. And it could be by tone of voice or sense of humour or whatever, but it just draws you in and you want to follow him or her.
Well, your title is How to Write Like Tolstoy, and Anna Karenina has a very famous opening line, but partly because most people disagree with it. The line, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Well, you don't have to agree, you just have to be drawn in. I mean, the beginning of Pride and Prejudice is meant ironically, yet a lot of people think that was Jane Austen's point of view. The main thing, as I say, is to draw you in, and that can be done in a whole range of ways.
And you're also setting the tone for the book? You're giving us the voice from the start?
Crucially. I mean, Catcher in the Rye begins with this bad-tempered, self-absorbed screed from Holden Caulfield. But at once, he's there on the page, and Salinger catches you and never lets you go. So voice is crucial.
One decision every author needs to make early in the writing process concerns point of view, usually whether to tell the story in the third or first person, or if you're really adventurous in the second person. What are the advantages or disadvantages of those various approaches?
Well, there's first, second, third, but there's also third person plural, mm-hmm. which has been used, such as in The Virgin Suicides. One of the points, of course, if you've got a narrator who knows everything, he or she as author can tell you as much or as little as they want. If it's first person and you're inside the head of one of the characters, that gives an intimacy, but it also means that that person doesn't know, that they can guess at, what's going on in the heads of other people or in the actions of people outside their own point of vision. So writers can play with that, and not only that, they can play with unreliable narrators, people who are half crazy, as in Sound and the Fury, and so on.
Or the first time I really became aware of that, which was Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, where I was reading the book and I said, wait a minute, didn't he say earlier? And then I realized that that was part of what the book was about.
Yeah.
And that was part of the pleasure of reading the book and figuring out what this man was really all about.
Now, I had a friend who read the book and said, I don't like to know what's going on under the bonnet. I don't want to see
the bonnet being the British,
version of the car. What's happening in the engine, mm-hmm. or the engine room? And I hope that my enthusiasm for the writers comes through. But I think how the engine is built, what the writer struggled with, is fascinating. And you get, I mean, just yesterday somebody was telling me that Bruce Chatwin's view was that Anna Karenina, Tolstoy makes a mistake, that it's not necessary or true to Anna's character that she has to kill herself. And I've been thinking about that for the last 24 hours.
Well, a number of writers have told me that they've started a book in third person and then realized that they had to switch to first person or vice versa because they were frustrated with the limitations of what they had started with.
Very much so. One of the people I interviewed was Rose Tremaine, who's getting more and more of a reputation over here. And she wrote about a doctor in the court of Charles II and began it in the third person, and not least because it was a historical novel, she found that what she wrote, well, wasn't convincing her, so she didn't think it was going to convince other people. And then she wrote it in the first person, which in some ways is more ambitious, and immediately felt at home. And sometimes you have to try different points of view until you find the one that works best for your story.
My guest is Richard Cohn, who's a former publishing director of Hutchison and Hodder and Stoughton, founder of Richard Cohn Books. Have gone on to win the Pulitzer, the Booker, the Whitbread Costa Prizes, and more than 20 have been number one bestsellers. He's also written a couple of books of his own. And the one we are discussing is How to Write Like Tolstoy, A Journey into the Minds of Our Greatest Writers. It's published by Random House. We'll continue a conversation after this. We're back with Richard Cohn, whose latest book is How to Write Like Tolstoy, A Journey into the Minds of Our Greatest Writers. It's published by Random House. I mentioned earlier that you've also taught creative writing. So how do you weigh in on the debate of whether it's possible to teach someone to write or if it's something a person needs to be born with?
Creative writing is a bit of a boom industry now, not only in the States and in Britain, but Australia, New Zealand, India, pretty well worldwide, as people are encouraged to have the confidence to do it. And at the same time, there's been a lot of cynicism or criticism. You can't teach people to write. And I think I line up with Kurt Vonnegut, who's when he was teaching in the Iowa creative writing program, said, well, I can't teach people to create to create good fiction, but I liken myself to a good golf pro who can take one or two shots off their round.
You could teach them how to develop a good work ethic.
Having a good routine, knowing that you've got to write and read and write and read, these are things which people can be taught. But equally, both Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell began as pretty shoddy writers in their own view, and they both came across people who taught them. In Hemingway's case, Gertrude Stein was an enormous help. In George Orwell's, there was a London-based woman poet whom he showed his early works to. And she said they read like a cow trying to shoot a musket. And she helped him by showing about sentence lengths, how to put what was important in the right place, how not to clear your throat. An awful lot of fiction writers have what I call throat-clearing first sentences, first paragraphs.
Such as?
Well, maybe this doesn't count, but it's something which I find is fun, is when the French decided to translate The Brothers Karamazov, they thought Dostoevsky gives us all these names in the first chapter. No French reader is going to be able to put up with that. So they scrapped the first chapter completely.
Oh, thank you very much. but a translation should try to at least be partly faithful to the original work.
Well, I'm sure you're right, Leonard. Remember that the Riwayat of the Omar Khayyam wasn't that successful until it got translated, and Fitzgerald's translation takes all kinds of liberties while remaining true to the spirit of the original.
A listener has called in to tell us that his favorite first paragraph was in Tuck Everlasting and wonders what you think about that.
He'd have to repeat it to me.
Which I don't have at hand.
I wish I could remember, you know, the first lines of all the books I've read. I mean, sometimes, you know, I remember when I was teaching creative writing to a class of about 150 students at a university in London, I produced the first line of Anna Karenina, Pride and Prejudice, Call Me Ishmael, It Was the Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times, and there wasn't a single sound of recognition from these students. And I then quoted the first line from the first Harry Potter book. You can imagine.
Well, that's sad, actually. But I wonder about the role of an editor, because, as I mentioned earlier, you've edited some pretty successful books over the years. We have heard about how Thomas Wolfe probably would never have become a famous writer if he hadn't had a very great editor. But have you had to pretty much rewrite some of your author's books?
I think that editors ought to remain in the background. I used to get teased because for 9 years I've edited both literary fiction and strong commercial fiction. And I, for 9 years, edited the novels of Geoffrey Archer. And people would say, oh, you really write them, which I didn't at all. He's very much his own man. But there's a great deal of rewriting that went on. But it's more often me saying, look, we need a sentence doing this, and he would then do it. But, you know, you'd miss things. I gave the first couple of pages of one of his novels to a creative writing class, and I gave it in the finished version, and I then showed them the draft as I had edited it. And one of the students said, sir, Professor Cohen, the first line, there's a mistake in it. And the first line read something like, when I was born, my father was in jail. But I completely failed to see that Jeffrey Archer had spelt it, when I was born, my father was in goal. Uh-huh. And that was only a spelling mistake. It wasn't
the British spelling of jail, which is G-A-O-L, right?
I'm learning American. Yes, you're quite right. Yeah.
But goal is G-O-A-L.
Yes.
And we spell it J-A-I-L in this country.
But it varies. I edited a lot of the novels of Faye Weldon, who's a great feminist, is still a great feminist. And on one of her novels, I said, all the male characters are unsympathetic. And it's just unbalanced. I mean, you're not even doing your cause or what you believe, giving it the right weight. I said, all right, Richard, that's very grateful for that editorial suggestion. So at that time I was living in Battersea, and she created the husband of the main character called Richard, who lives in Battersea and is killed off in the last chapter.
Revenge is sweet. I've spoken to a number of writers, enough writers who know that there is no one ideal approach. Some people want to have a pretty good idea of everything that's to come. Joyce Carol Oates, for example. John Updike told me he never wrote second drafts. He would just keep on writing the sentence until it was perfect in his mind. Others, Michael Ondaatje, told me that he wrote every day, sat down with a blank slate and then just wrote. And then after he came up with 500 pages, he'd look back and say, now what is this book all about? And then it would become the novel that it became in the second and third drafts.
Well, people need to choose the way that's going to suit them. And, you know, Charles Dickens rewrote The End of Great Expectations 3 or 4 times after thinking he'd finished with it and it's all that he wanted. There's a wonderful book published last year called Love, Nina. In England, it was a surprise bestseller. And it's the letters in real life written by a 20-year-old girl from outside London, from Leicester, to her sister, and she, the girl, was the au pair or nanny to a woman who had been the co-founder of the London Review of Books, who had 2 sons aged 11 and 9. And the 9-year-old was always writing a novel. And Nina, the au pair nanny, said, Jack, how's the novel going? He said, well, it's great, but I'm having some problems. And she said, well, what's it about? Can you give me a sense of how you're planning it? He said, I'm not planning it. And she said, but you've got to give signs, signals, help to the reader. And he replied, I am the reader.
Mm.
And I think for some novelists, they like to plan to the nth degree what they're writing. And others may have a sense of where they're going, but they want, almost like the reader, to be surprised by what their imagination comes up with.
You deal with this in 2 chapters titled Vision and Revision. Now, the suggestion there is that revision usually is the best way to go, to go back and...
It's my probably rather plodding way of saying, well, revision in one sense is just looking for repetitions, small improvements, getting rid of literals or minor inconsistencies. And I wanted to say, but it should be revision. In other words, you want to look at whether it's short story, novella, novel, absolutely with fresh eyes, and almost starting again, saying, what am I trying to do?
And then you discover things that will make it better that you didn't realize were there the first time. My guest is Richard Cohen, whose latest book is How to Write Like Tolstoy, A Journey into the Minds of Our Greatest Writers. It's published by Random House. During your research, didn't you discover that writing and editing require different brain functions?
It seemed to be that way. My wife, who's a literary agent, would come home, and I might be on the telephone, and she could tell from my tone of voice whether I was Richard the editor or Richard the author. And it's not what I intended, but it's as if there were two different people within the one brain.
You reveal that some of our most highly regarded classics are the result of extensive rewriting, which includes Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, Tolstoy's War and Peace. His poor wife had to copy it by hand 7 times.
I'm sure that if his wife, Sonia, were to come back in any age, it would be the age of the computer, so she didn't have to suffer that again. If one looks at the pages that we have of some of the greatest authors, when they get it back from the printer, you'll see not just Tolstoy, but Balzac. Both of them have sometimes more writing on the printed page in corrections than there was there originally in print.
And we've had, I've done a number of things where I've had writers read, and they will change the text because as they are reading it aloud, they realize they would prefer another word.
Well, it goes back to the importance of rhythm, and most writers will say it's crucial to read your works aloud. And there are examples of, I mean, Kafka, who one thinks of as a pretty dour guy, when he was, he'd read his books aloud to a group of friends and sometimes just be roaring with laughter over the most sad and tragic sequences. But Flaubert, you know, the great French novelist, used to write in a house bordering the Seine, bordering a forest, and he would go out into the forest, often late at night, and just declaim to the trees to give him a sense of whether sentences worked or not in terms of their rhythm.
Have you ever worked with a manuscript that needed almost no revision?
Once or twice, but it's not happened with fiction. A great friend of mine now called Hilary Sperling, who wrote a 2-volume biography of Matisse,
Wrote, was on our show to talk about it.
She's wonderful. She's got a new book she's just finishing. But she writes one draft, and they come out perfectly. And I think I used to tease her that she didn't place the adverb only in the right place. And that was really me desperate to make some kind of contribution. But it's important as an editor to know when to leave alone as well as when to meddle or give advice.
Plagiarism has been in talk of it in the air recently. You include a chapter on plagiarism. Isn't plagiarism a more complicated topic than most people understand?
I found it so. I've got a marvelous editor at Random called Will Murphy, and initially he didn't want the plagiarism chapter in. He didn't think it belonged. And it took a while to convince him. And I argued that you've got really 3 stages or kinds of plagiarism. One is the obvious case when a student just cribs things off the internet, Wikipedia or whatever, and hands it in as their own work. And that also happens with some renowned writers with reputations.
Didn't T.S. Eliot encourage stealing?
Oh, yes. He said, you know, good authors, people know that, his famous dictum, that between people who steal and people who adapt. But the second stage to which that Eliot view belongs is when you give added value. And you've got people, well, one of the things through the history of literature is plagiarism was not the kind of crime, kind of like bad table manners, as someone likened it to. Sometimes it was actually encouraged, and the ancient Romans regarded it as a kind of obeisance to the past to be able to repeat lines, sometimes wholesale, sometimes with slight changes, that had been originally made by great writers of the past.
On the eve of the opening ceremonies of the Summer Olympic Games, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that you were a champion fencer, and during the 1970s and 80s, you were chosen 4 times to compete in the Olympics for the British fencing team. Did you take home any medals?
Yeah, we all got a commemorative medal for having been in attendance. I think my best result was I came 21st in the 1984 Olympics, which sounds relatively okay until people remember that none of the Soviet bloc took part. But they were wonderful experiences.
And now I think the fencing team is one of the only Russian teams that's going to be allowed in this current Olympics. Does the United States or the UK have any good medal prospects in contention this summer?
The United States, who used to be totally out of it in terms of fencing, or near as, from the time of the Beijing Olympics, really made their mark. And when China held the Olympics, At the end of the first week, fully 10% of American medals were from fencing. And there are certainly some very good fencers in the American team. And the British team have got a real chance in what's one of the three weapons, foil, épée, sabre, in the foil event.
When you see some of those old Errol Flynn movies, do you wince or do you think that they did a pretty good job?
Well, my first national coach went from competing for Britain in the Helsinki Olympics in 1952 to go straight to Hollywood, where he was asked to train Errol Flynn in the Master of Ballantrae. And he continued to teach, well, not teach, to manage the fight scenes right up through to the Zorro films, the Hobbit adventures and so on. And I got onto him to say, when I was writing my first book, which was a history of swordplay through the ages, 3,000 years of it, could I go watch him stage manage a film scene? And he said, no. And I said, Bob, you old so-and-so, why can't I? And he said, because you're going to be in it. And he said, I'm doing a fight scene for a James Bond movie.
Die Another Day.
And you're going to be one of the people in the fencing room where the scene takes place.
So you were just an observer, or did you play a real part?
I think if you blink twice, you'll miss my contribution. But I did have the chance to speak to Piers Brosnan, who was lovely. I was talking to him about how to get his footwork right in the fight scene, and he lapsed into Cod Irish and said, our Brosnans always have trouble with our feet. And I had a really intimate conversation with Madonna, who came off after her scene. And I said, you did it really well. And she looked at me scathingly and said, gee, thanks.
You said you were in the midst of writing a novel.
I wouldn't say
you're following
in the
your
midst.
Own advice.
I'm not in the midst. I had the foolish notion of writing more than one book at one time. And I wrote 50 pages of a novel, which crazily is set just after the Second World War, so it needs a lot of research. And it's partly scenes and partly outline. And I gave it to my wife, who said, you're under contract to write a non-fiction book for Random House. You're not allowed to write another word of the novel. It's good enough to go on with, but don't write another word until you've finished.
And you have finished it. That's why I was asking you. Are you back to the novel?
I was actually writing two non-fiction books, the one on Tolstoy and a book called The History of Historians, which was the one that was actually commissioned first. So I'm not a very good advertisement for being a good author.
Well, we may see you back for that book, right? Meanwhile, we have this one, How to Write Like Tolstoy, A Journey into the Minds of Our Greatest Writers. It is published by Random House. Richard Cohen, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.